and welcome to the podcast. This is Ron's Amazing Stories, where we play tales to take you away from today. Well, no horror express this week. But we do have a pretty good show. There will be sled dogs, mysteries, and science fiction scary stuff. Do you want some more?
Yeah!
How about stuff to make you think and even a famous speech?
That's what I'm talking about.
So let's get this going with this non-lethal 5-minute mystery. This 5-minute mystery is being brought to you by Ron's Amazing Stories. If you need a story, you can count on Ron's Amazing Stories. We tell the stories that other podcasts won't. So tell your friends about the show.
Daily!
Oh, you're soaked to the skin. Come in here, son, out of the cold.
Thanks.
What happened? I've been robbed, sir. They attacked me, took the money, and tried to drown me in the south.
Well, here, get yourself warm and dry. This sounds like a case for the police to me. I'll phone them.
Mr. Daly, suppose you tell us the story exactly as it happened.
I told Mr. Winthrop here that I'd make a delivery for him this evening after the store closed.
Daly here works for me down at the jewelry store, Inspector. The other day, a customer came into the store and bought a very valuable necklace from me. They left it with an engraving on the shelf.
I see. And Daly here was to deliver it when it was finished, eh? By the way, Winthrop, is that your dog there or Daly?
Oh, he's mine, Inspector. He's quite fond of Daly, though. Well, to get on with the story. The night after work, Daly took the necklace and went out to the point to deliver it.
Well, they paid me, and I got back into my car to come back to town. Just as I came around the curve out there where the road runs along by the yacht club, I was stopped.
Stopped? By what?
Another car. Two men got out of it and ordered me to give them the money I'd collect. When I refused, they hit me over the head with a blackjack and took the money. They thought they'd kill me or something because they threw me into the sound from the yacht club's dock.
Oh, heavens, David, it's a miracle you didn't drown.
The cold water brought me to it, yes. I swam back to the dock and managed to get back to town in the car.
Good work, Daly. By the way, Winthrop, that dog of yours seems to be thirsty.
What's that, Inspector?
Yeah, you'd better get him a drink. Just look, he's really lapping up the water that's dripped off Daly's coat here. Well, now, Mr. Winthrop, I'm going to make a phone call. And Daly, you sit right where you are. If I'm right, and I'm sure I am, I'm placing you under arrest. You weren't robbed at all. You stole that money yourself.
Gave the inspector the answer to his problem. Stay with us and you'll find out in just a minute. But first...
Well, we don't have a murder today, and they do have a motive. That has to be a first for the show. I believe the police got this one right, and I think I know the clue. The detective sure was interested in that dog and the fact that he was really thirsty. Let's see if I'm right.
Now, back to our 5-minute mystery.
Me? Under arrest? Well, how do you figure that out, Inspector?
Look, Daly, that phone call I just made cinched it. I took a look at your coat. Not a ring on it, but it had started to dry. And salt water always leaves a ring. And then when that dog there started drinking the water that had dripped off your coat, I was sure my idea was right.
What are you talking about, Inspector? The sounds of salt of the ocean?
That's just it, Winthrop. That water on Daly's coat is as fresh as the water from your tap. Dogs don't drink salt water like that. I sent a man out to Daly's house before I come up here. I had him look at the bathtub just now. And Daly even forgot to run the water out of it when he dunked himself. Seems to me you picked a mighty uncomfortable way to get yourself in jail, Daly. It's getting cold out these nights to be running around town in a wet suit.
Well, how about that? I got one right, and the plot even made sense. Sort of. I do know that dogs will drink salt water and make themselves sick. Drinking too much salt water can lead to dehydration and other unpleasant things. Oh well. This 5-Minute Mystery was brought to you by Ron's Amazing Stories. I have to ask a question. Do you listen to Spotify? Spotify has over 140 million active listeners and 70 million of those subscribe. It is available in 61 markets, and that includes everything from Thailand to Poland. That is a whole lot of people. Now, why am I telling you this? Did you know that Ron's Amazing Stories can be heard on the Spotify mobile app? It's true, and I need your help. If you use Spotify, will you help out the show and follow us? Just search for Ron's Amazing Stories and click on that follow button. Do you have friends that use the app? Tell them about the show, and maybe they'll follow us too. Thank you for listening to the show, no matter how you do it. But if you use Spotify, give us a hand. Apple Podcast listeners may have noticed a bit of a change in the podcast. This past weekend, I have updated every podcast so that now they have a season number and an episode number. This was a big job, and I want to thank my service provider, Liberated Syndication, for making it much easier by creating a tool for me to edit more than 300 shows. So, for the record, Season 2 is Ron's Amazing Stories, and Season 1 is The Horror Express. There are currently 19 episodes of that show. Someday, I may make The Horror Express its own podcast. But for now, I hope it makes it easier for you to separate them. Also, if you are a Apple Podcast or iTunes listener, please take a minute and rate the show. 5 stars would be nice, but anything helps. I received an email from Peter M. of Detroit, Michigan. He says, "Love the show and listen every week. I listen to you on my iPhone. I got to thinking the other day and wondered which service give you the best results. I'll bet it's Apple. Am I right?" Well, Pete, can I call you Pete? You're wrong. Amazing as it sounds, the number one provider is Stitcher Radio. Here are the numbers for downloads for the last month or so. 6,610 came from Stitcher. 6,361 came from Apple Core Media. Pretty close race, but at least this month, Stitcher came on top. If you're interested in iHeartRadio, that number was 865. And way down the list is Spotify at 160. Now keep in mind that those are downloads, and some providers stream the podcast, so I can't know for sure what they do. For example, I have no idea what my number is on Google Play or TuneIn Radio. I'm guessing they must be pretty good. And now, this. Our OTR story comes from way up north, the challenge of the Yukon. It began as a 15-minute serial airing locally from 1938 until 1947. Shortly thereafter, the program acquired a sponsor, Quaker Oats, and the series moved to the networks. That program aired on ABC from 1947 to 1949 in a brand new 30-minute format. What I'm going to play today is one of the 15-minute shows from the pre-network days. It is called The 11th Hour and first aired late in 1943.
The Challenge of the Yukon. King, the swiftest, strongest of Eskimo lead dogs, blazes the trail through storm and snow for Sergeant Preston as he meets the Challenge of the Yukon. Sergeant Preston was typical of the small band of Northwest Mounted Police who preserved law and order in the Yukon during the gold rush of 98. That was the year that brought over 50,000 men swarming into the Klondike region. And the greed for gold led to frequent violence and bloodshed. But in spite of the odds against them, the force preserved a splendid record in maintaining the right. The challenge of the North was answered, and justice ruled triumphant. The bank in Dobie City was a small frame building rich in gold deposits from some of the finest claims in the Yukon. Late afternoon, two men faced Bid Miller, Dobie's banker, guns leveled as the small man faced them defiantly.
You won't dare to shoot. The whole town would be here in 2 minutes.
2 minutes would be all we need to get out of here. Open that safe, Miller.
I'm not opening those safe doors.
What do you want to fool around for, Sam? Come on, let him have it.
For the last time, open that safe.
You'll never get away with this.
We'll get away with it, all right. What are you waiting for? Go on, turn that combination.
That's what I call being real persuasive now, Sam.
Yeah. Maybe our friend here is sensible after all.
You'll see how sensible I am. You might carry this gold out of here, but mark my words, you'll never get away with it.
Open the doors. Lift that gold out of the safe. All of it.
Yeah. We don't want to miss any.
This is even better than you said.
What a haul this is. Wait till the boss sees it.
Any more in there?
Any more? Do you see any more?
I guess Shorty here's giving us all the help we need, Tony.
Yeah, I get you, Sam.
No, no. Wait a minute.
You talk too much. This is just to keep you from putting some miners on our trail.
You dirty yellow skunks. There ain't a drop of red blood in either of you. I'll see to...
That's it. It'll be a long time before he can tell anything. Gather up the rest of them folks. The sooner we get out of here, the better.
Sergeant Preston was a good 3 hours from Dobie City as he urged King on toward a small cabin standing alone in a clearing. A strong wind bit into him sharply.
On, King! On, you Huskies! Ah, that smoke from the chimney certainly looks good. All right, King. Ho, you Huskies! Ho! That's it, fella. We'll stop in to see Mort Kramer.
Hey, what's...
Hello there, Mort. How are you?
Well, Preston... It's a long time since you stopped by in these parts.
Oh, just on my way to Dobie, Mort. I thought I'd stop in for a while. How's everything going?
Well, about the same as usual. Come on in. It's so cold up here, I don't know how men stand it.
Well, that's the Yukon for you. As I remember it, you never did like the climate.
You want to bring your dog in?
No, no, King will stay out here. We'll rest a few minutes before going on.
Sit down. Tell me what brings you to these parts. You say you're going to Dobie City?
That's right.
Yep.
It's gold robberies again, Mort.
Oh, yeah?
A group of men have been systematically robbing banks all the way from Skagway to... Well, that's just it. To where? One after the other.
Well, you got any information that makes you think they're around here?
Yes and no. If I'm right, I have a hunch Dobie will be their next stopping off place.
Well, it all goes to prove I'm right. I always said it's no use banking your dust. Just puts it all in one place for the first smart crook that comes along to clean up.
Oh, I think you're wrong there, Mort. Banks are necessary up here. And it's up to the law to protect them.
Maybe I shouldn't say so. But you ain't done much protecting up to now. I mean, well, they were robbed.
You've got a point in favor of your argument, Mort. But it's my job to stop those robberies.
I wish you luck, Sergeant. They must be a mighty slick gang.
Now, what's that?
Get down, you mutt. Tell me, what's the idea?
This is a fresh team.
What do you two want?
What do we want?
Are these friends of yours, Mort?
Friends of mine. I never saw them before.
A Mountie, huh?
If you two stop for grub,
yeah,
well...
Yeah, we thought we could buy some from you, mister.
Looks more to me as if you thought you could take my team. It's all right, King. Where are you heading for?
Pikeston. And if it's all the same to you, Monty, we'll march.
Where'd you come from?
Why the gun, Sergeant? They don't
These
look like...
men will have to come to Dobie with me, Mort.
Dobie? Well, you're daft. We're going to Pikeston.
You're both going to Dobie with me and explain those bags from the Dobie City Bank on your sled.
What? Oh, say. I'd have never noticed them.
They weren't very carefully put on the sled. Two of them slipped from under that pack. All right, you two. Here, put these handcuffs on them, Mort.
No, you can't do this.
Well, he's doing it, ain't he? Now, shut up. Maybe you think your boss can get you out of this one, huh?
Maybe he better, mister.
Say, these might be the men you were looking for, Sergeant.
Well, we'll soon find out. I imagine the banker and Dobie will be able to throw a lot of light on the subject. Get the dogs up, King.
All right, just a minute, Sergeant. I'll go to Dobie with you. It ain't every day I get a chance to watch the law working on bank robbers.
It was late afternoon as Sergeant Preston closed the doors on his two prisoners in Dobie City. And it was an excited banker who stood by, grinning triumphantly.
Yes, sir. They're the ones, all right. Made me open a safe that hit me on the head. I still got a bump. Oh, still hurts, too.
I wanted you to identify them, Bid.
Last thing I said to them was that they wouldn't get away with it. Now who's laughing, boys? Sergeant Preston, I got to hand it to you. If it hadn't been for you, well, I hate to think of what would have happened.
It's a little too soon to hand anything to anybody, Bid.
What do you mean, Sergeant?
Well, it's true that we've got the robbers jailed.
And you've got the gold back in the bank. Seems to me
No, there's more to it than that. Much more. You see, Bid, there's someone else behind these robberies. I'm convinced of it.
Say.
Hmm?
Now that you mention it, when I swung the safe doors open, one of them said, just wait till the boss sees this.
Did they say anything else? Anything more definite?
No, that's all. Maybe you can get them to tell who it is. They're all alike. Once they get in a tight spot, they'll tell everything they know.
I've already talked to them.
No luck?
No. But they may change their minds. I'm convinced that these are the men who've been responsible for those robberies in Belle Vista, Doriston, Hightop.
You're right. Then they're the ones that must have killed O'Toole in Hightop.
Hey, look, Sam. We got visitors again. Hey, well, what do you want, Marty?
I'm giving you two a chance to lighten your sentences.
That's mighty interesting. But if you're here to ask for names, you're wasting your time.
A miner's jury won't go easy on you unless you help me get the man in back of you two. You have nothing to lose and everything to gain.
You're right on one thing. We got everything to gain just by staying here waiting.
And waiting for what? You'll be convicted of robbery while your boss makes a getaway with the gold he's holding from those other banks.
Marty, we ain't talking.
Well, suit yourself. There's a chance for you to help yourself.
We'll get help, all right. And you can put this in your books. We won't be here long enough to be convicted by a miner's jury. See?
Easy to see they ain't got a brain between them. There ain't a soul in Dobie to be likely to spread the news of you two being in jail where it do you any good.
We don't need anybody to spread the news, Shorty.
All right. Come on, Bid.
Save your breath, Monty. You'll need it to explain why your jail's empty when the jury gets together.
What do you make of it, Sergeant? They seem mighty sure of themselves.
Yes. Too sure.
I don't understand it.
Well, there's only one explanation.
What's that?
Put yourself in their place, Bid. If you were jailed here in Dobie City and your boss was, say, over in Pikeston, what would you do?
Why, I'd try to get word to him, I guess.
You wouldn't be so sure that you could get word to him in time to get out of facing a trial that's 2 days away, would you?
No, I wouldn't. And if I was in their shoes, I'd either make sure he'd face that trial with me, or I'd break my neck seeing somebody that'd tell him to get me out of jail, or else.
Well, they haven't talked to anyone since Mort and I brought them in.
And yet they're so plumb sure that... it beats me.
There's only one answer to it. The man we're looking for must be right here in Dobie City.
Right here. Say, who do you suppose... That must be it.
Yes, of course it is.
In that case, the only thing to do is to double the guard on the jail and make sure he don't get the chance to spring them. By golly, that's it. And when they see that trial coming up and no help from their boss, they'll be...
No, I think, Bid, that we'll force his hand.
What?
We'll give this boss of theirs just the chance he's waiting for.
Well, I don't get you. You mean you know who he is?
No, I don't know who he is.
Well, then, you're going to take a chance on leaving the jail unguarded?
If we leave the jail obviously unguarded, he'd suspect the trick immediately. Remember, this is the man responsible for a string of bank robberies that he's gotten away with up till now. Now, he'd be too smart to fall for a trap like that. I'll need your help, Bid, and King.
I'll do anything I can, but I still don't see
King how... King and I are going down to the wharf, then upstream a bit. Tomorrow morning, I want you... Early the next morning, miners thronged the streets in Dobie City. They were gathered in the cafe, in the general store, and lounging outside the frame buildings bordering Main Street. When suddenly, Bid Miller came racing from the wharf at the riverfront at the street's end.
Hey! There's a man in the river! Preston's dog's trying to pull him out!
What?
Yeah!
Man in the river!
I want to see that! Come on, Mike!
It was a stampede. Men who were hungry for excitement and entertainment raced down to the wharf, some of them already laying bets on whether or not the dog would be successful in pulling the man out of the rushing waters of the Yukon River. As Bid ran past the jail, he called to the guard.
Don't you want to see it, Clem?
Sure.
Come on, this is too good to miss. Sandy can keep his eyes on them two prisoners.
I got him right with you, Bid. I'll lay you 2-1. That dog don't make it.
The street that only 2 minutes before had been crowded with men was deserted. Mort Kramer walked out of the cafe and slipped up behind the one guard left standing outside of the jail. The man was facing the wharf, listening intently to the wild cries of the miners. He never realized his danger till Mort was upon him.
Oh!
Now to get the keys. Good. Lady Luck's playing right into my hands. To find which one of these
is. Hey, what the... Mort.
Yeah, it's me.
For a while there, he's beginning to worry about you.
You knew better than that. What did you think I came to town with the Mountie for?
What'd I tell you, Sam? See? Boy, will that Mountie be surprised. How'd you manage this?
Preston managed it. All right, come on. My sled's in back at the cafe.
What do you mean, Preston managed it?
Every miner in town is watching that dog of his pull some fool out of the river.
Oh, his dog, huh? I hope that mutt never gets out.
Just the chance I was waiting for.
Yeah. Well, it's a good thing for you it came up. Because if it hadn't, we'd have told enough about them robberies to hang you.
Fool, what could I do in front of Preston? Come on, we've wasted enough time. Preston might be back any minute.
You're wrong, Mort. Not any minute, right now.
Preston!
Drop those keys, put your hands up.
This was a trap, you fool!
Yes, it was a trap.
But I thought...
You thought I was down at the river with the miners. That the coast was clear. I should have known when these two stopped at your cabin, Mort, that it was all prearranged. That your cabin is the hideout. But I've got enough evidence now to put you just where you belong.
Hey, Sergeant, what happened to Sandy?
That wasn't any man, just a dummy. Somebody stuffed a suit of clothes and sent it down the river.
Did it work, Sarge? Mort!
Yes, Bid, it worked. Mort Kramer's the man we're looking for. I was standing behind the office door waiting for him, and he walked right into the trap. I think we'll find the gold from those other robberies out at his cabin.
Well, I'll
Sergeant,
be...
Sergeant, I don't get this.
You'll hear about it in court tomorrow, Tim. Lock them all up, Bid.
Well, even if it was a dummy, you should have seen that dog of yours swimming. I never seen anything like it.
Good work, fella. Good work. Yes, with your help, another case has been solved. Upholding the motto of the Northwest Mounted Police, Sergeant Preston and the Great Dog King maintain the right and get their man. Don't miss their next thrilling adventure when they meet the challenge of the Yukon once again on Saturday at this same time.
On King! On you, Husky!
Challenge of the Yukon, a copyrighted feature of the Challenge of the Yukon, Incorporated, brought to you every Saturday at this time, originated in the transcription studios of WXYZ Detroit. The characters and events in tonight's drama were fictitious. Bill Morgan speaking. This is the Michigan Radio Network.
I liked that show. I thought it was pretty good. Think about this. What you heard only took 14 minutes and 9 seconds to run. Yet somehow, you got a complete story. That has to mean that the writers did a pretty good job. And now, this moment in time. The date is May 24th, 1950, and this is A Moment in Time. Have you seen the 2017 movie Dunkirk? If you haven't, I highly recommend it. It tells the amazing story of one of history's greatest rescues. Some 330,000 British troops were trapped with no way to escape. It was the common citizen that came to the rescue by providing just about anything that floated. What you're about to hear is an interview with one of those citizens, Charles Herbert Lightoller. He was a true hero of Dunkirk. Listen to this.
Now, Commander, can you tell me when you first got the stand to for the Dunkirk evacuation?
That was on the evening of May the 31st, about 5 o'clock. They rang me up from the Admiralty, chap I knew at the Admiralty, asking, could I meet him on board at 7 o'clock?
They knew about your boat?
Oh, yes, I knew them. And so at 7 o'clock I met him down there. He said the Admiralty were going to requisition her for going over to Dunkirk. They wanted me to take her round to Ramsgate, where they said that a naval crew would take her over. I told them that they had another guest coming. If anybody was going to take her over, well, my eldest son and I were. So we came out on the morning of the 1st of June and got down as far as Westminster. Later on, we anchored at Gravesend. From there to Southend, and eventually to Ramsgate.
Just the two of you?
Just the three of us.
Three of us? Who was the other?
Three. A sea scout, about an 18-year-old sea scout. And at Ramsgate, we got charts, and the other boats seemed to have trickled off behind. Well, we were fairly fast and had rather left them. So we pushed over to Dunkirk on our own.
Were you attacked on the way?
Yes, we had lots of fun on the way. The first one was a couple of enemy bombers had a shot at it, and fortunately, Worcester, HMS Worcester, was just passing us at the time, and she drove them off. But then we had lots of other escapes from bombing and machine gunning until we got over the other side, where I picked up the crew of a small motor cruiser called Westerly. She was well on fire. We picked them off, and she had a couple of hundred gallons of petrol on board, so they said. In any case, when we got about half a mile away from her, she blew up. Next thing was we went through the wreckage and other evidences from a big French transport that had been sunk. That was off Gravelines. Later on into Dunkirk, because I was told that all the men were then off the beaches. So I went into the harbor, and alongside Worcester, I went on board and saw the captain and told him I could take a few men. So he said, how many? Well, I once had 21 on board. I didn't tell him that. I told him, about 100. And so he said, right, take them. And they started to pour on board of us, and down below, Rogers, as arranged, was stowing them down below.
That was your son?
That was my son, yes. And one of the naval ratings was tallying them on board. When he got about 50 down below, I asked him how he was getting on. And he said, plenty of room yet. Then at 75, I asked him how he was then. Oh, is it getting a bit crowded? So then we took the rest on deck. We tallied up a total of 130. Then I found that she was getting pretty tender, so I called a halt then and cast off and started on my way back.
Were you attacked on the way back?
Yes, several times. But she's very quick on her helm, and on one occasion a fighter came down up astern of us, and I learned from my youngest son, who was in the Air Force, certain things that I knew the attacking aircraft had to do to before she could bring her guns to bear. So just as she was bringing her guns to bear, put the helm hard over, and as I say, she's very quick on her helm and dodged him.
She was quick on her helm even with all those people on
very
board?
Very quick, yes. And then the aircraft banked and had another go, and we put the helm over the other way and dodged him again.
He no casualties?
He gave it up then as a bad job.
And you got back safely, obviously.
Got back to Ramsgate, went alongside. They started to pile off then. There was a chief petty officer was tallying them ashore. And as the last ones went over the side, his remark stays in my mind. My God, mate, he said, where did you put them?
In the 2017 movie, Charles' story is told, although the film is actually a collection of stories. I loved how it was all put together, and in my opinion, Dunkirk is one of the best war films to date. The actual events took place from May 26th to June 4th in the year 1940. Winston Churchill gave a speech on June 4th, which is listed as one of the planet's greatest. It has been titled, We Shall Fight on the Beaches. Here is the last few minutes of that famous monologue.
At any rate, that is what we are going to try to do. That is the resolve of His Majesty's government, every man of them. That is the will of Parliament and the nation. The British Empire and the French Republic, linked together in their cause and in their need, will defend to the death their native soil, aiding each other like good comrades to the utmost of their strength. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world with all its power and might steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
I hope you enjoyed that, and this was A Moment in Time.
As read by Amazing Stories, read by Amazing People.
This time on As Read By, we have a story called I'll Kill You Tomorrow by Helen Huber. It is read for us by Mark Nelson. The world has labeled this one as science fiction, but if I had to put it in a genre, I would put it in horror. I'll let you settle that score in your own mind. It first appeared in the November 1953 edition of IF magazine. I think you're going to enjoy this one.
I'll Kill You Tomorrow by Helen Huber. It was not a sinister silence. No silence is sinister until it acquires a background of understandable menace. Here, there was only the night quiet of maternity, the silence of noiseless rubber heels on the hospital corridor floor, the faint brush of starched white skirts brushing through doorways into darkened and semi-darkened rooms. But there was something wrong with the silence in the basket room of maternity, the glass-walled room containing row on row the tiny hopes of tomorrow. The curtain was drawn across the window through which, during visiting hours, peered the proud fathers who did the hoping. The nightlight was dim. The silence should not have been there. Lori Kane, standing in the doorway, looked out over the rows of silent baskets and felt her blonde hair tighten at the roots. The tightening came from instinct, even before her brain had a chance to function, from the instincts and training of a registered nurse. 30-odd babies grouped in one room and complete silence. Not a single whimper, not one tiny cry of protest against the annoying phenomenon of birth. 30 babies dead? That was the thought that flashed unbidden into Lori's pretty head. The absurdity of it followed swiftly, and Lori moved on rubber soles between a line of baskets. She bent down and explored with practiced fingers. A warm, living bundle in a white basket. The feeling of relief was genuine. Relief, even from an absurdity, is a welcome thing. Lori smiled and bent closer. Staring up at Lori from the basket were two clear blue eyes. Two eyes, steady and fixed in a round baby face. An immobile pink baby face housing two blue eyes that stared up into Lori's with a quiet concentration that was chilling. Lori said, "What's the matter with you?" She spoke in a whisper and was addressing herself. She'd gone short on sleep lately, the only way, really, to get a few hours with Pete. Pete was an intern at General Hospital, and the kind of a homely grinning carrot top a girl like Lori could put into dreams as the center of a satisfactory future. But all this didn't justify a case of jitters in the basket room. Lori said, "Hi, short stuff," and lifted Baby Newcomb, male, out of his crib for a cuddling. Baby Newcomb didn't object. The blue eyes came closer, the weak old eyes with a 100-year-old look. Lori laid the bundle over her shoulder and smiled into the dimness. "You want to be president, Shorty?" Lori felt the warmth of a new life, felt the little body wriggle in snug contentment. "I wouldn't advise it. Tough job." Baby Newcomb twisted in his blanket. Lori stiffened. Snug contentment? Lori felt two tiny hands clutch and dig into her throat. Not just pawing baby hands, little fingers that reached and explored for the windpipe. She uncuddled the soft bundle, held it out. There were the eyes. She chilled. No imagination here. No specter from lack of sleep. Ancient murder hatred glowing in newborn eyes.
"Careful, you fool! You'll drop this body!"
A thin piping voice. A shrill symphony in malevolence. Fear weakened Lori. She found a chair and sat down. She held the boy baby in her hands. Training would not allow her to drop Baby Newcomb. Even if she had fainted, she would not have let go. The shrill voice,
"It was stupid of me. Very stupid."
Lori was cold, sick, mute.
"Very stupid. These hands are too fragile. There are no muscles in the arms. I couldn't have killed you." "Please, I... dreaming? No, I'm surprised at... well, at your surprise. You have a trained mind. You should have learned long ago to trust your senses." "I don't understand." "Don't look at the doorway. Nobody's coming in. Look at me. Give me a little attention, and I'll explain." "Explain?"
Lori pulled her eyes down to the cherubic little face as she parroted dully.
"I'll begin by reminding you that there are more things in existence than your obscene medical books tell you about." "Who are you? What are you?" "One of those things." "You're not a baby." "Of course I'm not. I'm—"
The beastly, brittle voice drifted into silence as though halted by an intruding thought. Then the thought voiced, voiced with a yearning at once pathetic and terrible.
"It would be nice to kill you. Someday I will. Someday I'll kill you if I can find you."
"Why? Why?" Insane words in an insane world. But life had not stopped even though madness had taken over. "Why?" The voice was matter-of-fact again. No more time for pleasant daydreams.
"I'm something your books didn't tell you about. Naturally, you're bewildered. Didn't you ever hear of a bodiless entity?"
Lori shuddered in silence.
"You've heard of bodiless entities, of course, but you denied their existence in your smug world of precise, tidy detail. I'm a bodiless entity. I'm one of a swarm. We come from a dimension your mind wouldn't accept even if I explained it, so I'll save words. We of the swarm seek unfoldment, fulfillment, even as you in your stupid, blind world. Do you want to hear more?" You're a fool, but I enjoy practicing with these new vocal cords just as I enjoyed flexing the fingers and muscles. That's why I revealed myself. We are basically, of course, parasites. In the dimension where we exist in profusion, evolution has provided for us. There we seek out and move into a dimensional entity far more intelligent than yourself. We destroy it in a way you wouldn't understand, and it is not important that you should. In fact, I can't see what importance there is in your existing at all.
You plan to kill all these babies?
Let me congratulate you. You finally managed to voice an intelligent question. The answer is no. We aren't strong enough to kill them. We dwelt in a far more delicate dimension than this one, and all was in proportion. That was our difficulty when we came here. We could find no entities weak enough to take possession of until we came upon this room full of infants.
Then, if you're helpless,
what do we plan to do? That's quite simple. These material entities will grow. We will remain attached, ingrained, so to speak. When the body's enlarged sufficiently...
30 potential assassins! Lori spoke again to herself, then hurled the words back into her own mind as her sickness deepened. The shrill chirping.
What do you mean, potential? The word expresses a doubt. Here, there is none.
The entity's chuckle sounded like a baby, content over a full bottle.
30 certain assassins!
But why must you kill? Lori was sure the tiny shoulders shrugged.
Why? I don't know. I never thought to wonder. Why must you join with a man and propagate someday? Why do you feel sorry for what you term an unfortunate? Explain your instincts, and I'll explain mine.
Lori felt herself rising. Stiffly, she put Baby Newcomb back into his basket. As she did so, a ripple of shrill, jerky laughter crackled through the room. Lori put her hands to her ears.
You know I can't say anything. You'd keep quiet. They'd call me mad. Precisely.
Malicious laughter, like driven sleet, cut into her ears as she fled from the room. Peter Larchmont, M.D., was smoking a quick cigarette by an open fire escape door on the third floor. He turned as Lori came down the corridor, flipped his cigarette down into the alley, and grinned.
"Women shouldn't float on rubber heels," he said. "A man should have warning."
Lori came close. "Kiss me. Kiss me hard." Pete kissed her, then held her away.
"You're trembling. Anticipation, pet?"
He looked into her face, and the grin faded.
"Lori, what is it?"
"Pete, Pete, I'm crazy. I've gone mad. Hold me."
He could have laughed, but he had looked closely into her eyes, and he was a doctor. He didn't laugh.
"Tell me. Just stand here. I'll hang on to you, and you tell me. The babies. They've gone mad. She clung to him. Not exactly that. Something's taken them over. Something terrible. Oh, Pete, nobody would believe me.
I believe the end result, he said quietly. That's what I'm for, Angel. When you shake like this, I'll always believe. But I'll have to know more, and I'll hunt for an answer.
There isn't any answer, Pete. I know.
We'll still look. Tell me more first.
There isn't any more.
Her eyes widened as she stared into his with the shock of a new thought.
Oh, Lord! One of them talked to me, but maybe he, or it, won't talk to you. Then you'll never know for sure. You'll think I'm...
Stop it. Quit predicting what I'll do. Let's go to the nursery. They went to the nursery and stayed there for 3/4 of an hour. They left with the tinny laughter filling their minds, and the last words of the monstrous entity.
We'll say no more, of course. Perhaps even this incident has been indiscreet. But it's in the form of a celebration. Never before has a whole swarm gotten through. Only a single entity on rare occasions.
Pete leaned against the corridor wall and wiped his face with the sleeve of his jacket.
We're the only ones who know, he said. Or ever will know.
Lori pushed back a lock of his curly hair. She wanted to kiss him, but this didn't seem to be the place or the time.
We can never tell anyone.
We'd look foolish.
We've got a horror on our hands, and we can't pass it on.
What are we going to do? Lori asked. I don't know. Let's recap a little. Got a cigarette? They went to the fire door and dragged long and deep on two from Lori's pack.
They'll be quiet from now on. No more talking, just baby squalls.
And 30 little assassins will go into 30 homes, Lori said. All dressed in soft pink and blue, all filled with hatred. Waiting, biding their time, growing more clever. She shuddered.
The electric chair will get them all eventually.
But how many will they get in the meantime?
Pete put his arms around her and drew her close and whispered into her ear.
There's nothing we can do. Nothing.
We've got to do something.
Lori heard again the thin, brittle laughter following her, taunting her.
It was a bad dream. It didn't happen. We'll just have to sleep it off.
She put her cheek against his. The rising stubble of his beard scratched her face. She was grateful for the rough touch of solid reality.
Pete said, "The shock will wear out of our minds. Time will pass. After a while, we won't believe it ourselves."
That's what I'm afraid of.
It's got to be that way.
We've got to do something.
Pete lowered his arms wearily.
Yeah, we've got to do something. Where there's nothing that can be done. What are we, miracle workers?
We've got to do something.
Sure, finish out the watch and then get some sleep.
Lori awoke with the lowering sun in her window. It was a blood-red sun. She picked up the phone by her bedside.
Room 307, residence extension.
Pete answered drowsily. Lori said,
"Tell me, did I dream or did it really happen?"
I was going to ask you the same thing. I guess it happened.
What are you doing?
Lying in bed.
So am I, but two different beds. Things are done all wrong.
Want to take a chance and sneak over? I've got an illegal coffee pot.
Leave the door unlocked. Lori put on the coffee. She showered and got into her slip. She was brushing her hair when Pete came in. He looked at her and extended, beckoning, clutching fingers.
The hell with phantoms. Come here.
After a couple of minutes, Lori pulled away and poured the coffee. She reached for her uniform. Pete said,
"Don't put it on yet."
Too dangerous, leaving it off. He eyed her dreamily.
I'll dredge up willpower. I'll also get scads of fat rich clients. Then we'll get married so I can assault you legally. Laurie studied him. You're not even listening to yourself. What is it, Pete? What have you dreamed up? Okay, I've got an idea. You said something would have to be done. What? A drastic cure for a drastic case, with maybe disaster as the end product. Tell me. I'll tell you a little, but not too much. Why not all? Because if we ever land in court, I want to be able to say under oath, he didn't tell me what he planned to do. I don't like that. I don't care if you like it or not. Tell me, what's the one basic thing that stands out in your mind about these entities? That they're fragile? Yes, fragile. Give me some more coffee. Laurie demanded to know what was in Pete's mind. All she got was kissed, and she did not see Pete again until 11 o'clock that night. He found her in the corridor in maternity and motioned her toward the nursery. He carried a tray under a white towel. He said, "You watch the door. I'm going inside. I'll be about a half an hour." "What are you going to do?" "You stay out here and mind your business. Your business will be to steer any nosy party away. If you can't, make noise coming in." Doc Pete turned away and entered the nursery. Laurie stood at the doorway, in the silence, under the brooding nightlight, and prayed. 25 minutes later, Pete came out. His face was white and drawn. He looked like a man who had lately had a preview of hell's inverted pleasures. His hands trembled. The towel still covered the tray. He said, "Watch them close. Don't move 10 steps from here." He started away, turned back. "All hell is scheduled to break loose in this hospital shortly. Let's hope God remains in charge." Larry saw the sick dread of his heart underneath his words. It could have been a major scandal. An epidemic of measles on the maternity floor of a modern hospital indicates the unforgivable medical sin, carelessness. It was hushed up as much as possible, pending the time when the top people could shake off the shock and recover their wits. The ultimate recovery of 30 babies was a tribute to everyone concerned. Wan, done in, Doc Pete drank coffee in Laurie's room. Laurie gave him 3 lumps of sugar and said, "But are you sure the sickness killed the entities?" "Quite sure. Somehow they knew when I made the injections. They screamed. They knew they were done for." It took courage. "Tell me, why are you so strong, so brave? Why are you so wonderful?" "Cut it out. I was scared stiff. If one baby had died, I'd have gone through life weighing the cure against the end. It isn't easy to risk doing murder, however urgent the need." She leaned across and kissed him. "And you were all alone. You wouldn't let me help. Was that fair?" He grinned, then sobered. "But I can't help remembering what that invisible monster said. Never before has a whole swarm gotten through. Only a single entity on rare occasions." "I can't help wondering what happens to those single entities. I think of the newspaper headlines I've seen. Child kills parents in sleep. Youth slays father. I'll probably always wonder, and I'll always remember." Laurie got up and crossed to him and put her arms around him. "Not always," she whispered. "There will be times when I'll make you forget. For a little while, anyhow." The end of I'll Kill You Tomorrow by Helen Huber. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. Recording by Mark Nelson.
Nicely read, Mark. As for that story, creepy as heck, and it was a real thinker. It makes you wonder if that's how psychopaths are born. Our story came from IF Magazine. This was an American science fiction magazine launched in March of 1952 by Quinn Publications. It was moderately successful, though it was never considered to be first tier. it achieved its greatest success under editor Frederick Poole. It won a Hugo Award for Best Professional Magazine 3 years running from 1966 to 1968. The most prominent writer to make his first sale to IF was Larry Niven, whose story, The Coldest Place, appeared in the December 1964 issue. IF was merged with Galaxy Science Fiction magazine in 1974. Now, why did I call this podcast Who is Helen Huber? Try as I might, I could not find any information on her. That was the normal practice for a lot of authors during the 50s. On my quest to find Helen, I did everything I could. I read obits, LinkedIn profiles, Facebook. I Googled everything, and the closest I came was a 96-year-old woman in New Mexico. She, at least, was a writer, but I couldn't find any of her credits. If you know who Ellen was, please let me know. I absolutely love her writing. How about that? This podcast is done and ready for archiving. I do not have an update at the time I'm recording this on the Next Horror Express. I'm hoping that the next episode is that show, but at this time there are no set plans to record it. So, I'll see you next week with something. If you want to follow the podcast or the blog, it's easy to do. Just head to ronsamazingstories.com. There you will find all of the links you will need. We are on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, TuneIn, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and many, many other services. Pick one and do leave some feedback on the show. It really does help us to grow. Thank you for listening, and I hope you come again to find out what are Ron's Amazing Stories.
All of the vintage audio used in the podcast is believed to be in the public domain. Ron's Amazing Stories does not own the rights to any of the old-time radio used here. If you hold the rights to any of the shows played, please contact us immediately at ronsamazingstories.com.